Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. How are you today on this September 3rd, 2013? This program, you know, is called It's All About Food, and I think if you don't believe that it is all about food right now, at the end of the hour, I am absolutely sure you will be convinced because everything is connected to food. So let's just jump right in and get my first guest on and talking because we've got a lot of things to talk about. David Simon is the author of a new book, Meatonomics. He's a lawyer and advocate for sustainable consumption. He works as general counsel for a healthcare company and serves on the board of the APRL Fund, a nonprofit dedicated to protecting animals. David received his BA from UC Berkeley and his JD from the University of Southern California. He's the author of the New Millennium Law Dictionary, a full-length legal dictionary. He lives in Southern California with his partner, artist Tanya Marie, and their rabbit, tortoise, and two cats. Welcome, David, to It's All About Food.
Hi, Karen. Thanks very much.
Yeah. So you wrote a pretty incredible book, Meatonomics, $ on the S.
That's right. Just released 2 days ago, in fact.
Very good. Well, I hope it does very well because everybody needs to read it.
Terrific.
There aren't that many books out on this subject. I've spoken with Marion Nestle a few times, and she's done a lot of work connecting all kinds of government issues, politics, actually. She came out with that first book, Food Politics, which was recently reissued, 10th anniversary. And then a while ago, I spoke with Anona Howder, who has a book talking about Foodopoly, the title, with the history of how we got to where we are today with our food system. And you've done an incredible job kind of summing up all of the economics behind our food system. And I want to tell you that reading your book and seeing all the billions of dollars referenced everywhere, it is quite overwhelming.
Yeah, it's a lot of money, isn't it? It's crazy.
It's just so much money and so unnecessary.
Yeah, you're right.
Okay, so let's check off some of these items here that are in your book, starting with the check-off program. Can you tell us a little bit about that? That's just one of these crazy things that has endured in this country and has not really helped.
Yeah, these check-off programs are really incredible. Nobody's heard of them. We're all affected by them, and we see and hear their messages on a regular basis. But very few people are actually familiar with how they work. A check-off program, just like check a box, is essentially a tax program that was enacted by Congress. And they apply to a number of commodities, but in particular, they apply to most animal foods. So there's one for pork, one for beef, eggs, lamb, fluid milk, and other dairy products. The way the programs work is they collect a small tax at the point of wholesale transaction. So the first wholesale buyer, typically like a packing house or a slaughterhouse, remits, for example, $1 per head of cattle to a central organization, and the funds are spent on promoting the animal food that's covered and doing research on that that essentially helps to convince consumers that those foods are healthy. The reason these programs are so significant in this country is that they are remarkably effective. When I added up the numbers that the checkoff programs themselves boast about, like this is how successful we are, it turns out that on average, for every dollar they collect and spend, they see something like $8 in additional sales.
Wow. Nobody can get a turnaround like that on money.
It's incredible, and what that means is each year they spend about $550 million, and the boost in sales of animal foods that relates to that is about $4.6 billion. It's a massive number. They're selling all Americans who eat these products somewhere between 5% and 7% more of these foods than people would be buying otherwise.
Now, why would the government care to have a program like this?
Well, that's a very good question. And in fact, you put your finger on another really important component of these programs, and that is they are backed by the U.S. government. In an important 2005 U.S. Supreme Court case, the court held that when a checkoff program speaks, it actually speaks the message of the federal government. So when you hear something like beef, it's what's for dinner, or pork, the other white meat, or milk, it does a body good, that's actually the federal government telling you to buy more meat, pork, or dairy. And your question is a wonderful one. I have no idea why our government would want people to buy more of these products, because across the board, in every demographic, the data shows that we're already eating more than the USDA recommends we do of these products. In every category, men of every age, women of every age, the USDA recommends a certain level, and we're exceeding it in every demographic group.
You know, I know when our country was going through war, at least war that we recognize as war, World War II, World War I, we had all these different propaganda policies because the men were overseas and the women were at home, and we wanted to send the meat overseas, and we all had to learn how to eat differently. And so we were encouraged back then by the government to grow our own food and eat more fruits and vegetables so that the better food, the protein food, could go over to our soldiers. But other than that, I don't know what the, other than certain people making money, what the point is why the government would want to go into ensuring marketing of these products. Is there a program like that for broccoli?
There are some programs like this for fruits and vegetables. Mangoes have a checkoff. Mushrooms have a checkoff. Blueberries have a checkoff. But the amounts of money are radically different. There's about $50 million spent on fruits and vegetable checkoff programs versus, as I mentioned, about $550 million spent on animal food checkoff programs. So it's apples and oranges, so to speak. Mm-hmm. There's not even a comparison.
Well, I believe that if we were putting some good money to marketing the benefits of fruits and vegetables and encouraging people to eat them, they would eat more of them if it was hip.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
You know, and there, you put your finger on another issue, which is federal subsidies. The ratio at which we subsidize meat and dairy compared to fruits and vegetables is also completely disproportionate. We spend something like $38 billion subsidizing meat and dairy and only $17 million subsidizing fruits and vegetables. That means that fruits and vegetables get 0.0004 of the funds that meat and dairy get in subsidies.
Now, it's very clear throughout your book that you are not encouraging the consumption of meat and dairy, that they're the big evils for many reasons. And I'm right there with you because I'm a vegan. I have been for 25 years, and I'm waiting for everybody to get the message. And some people are getting it, and there are so many angles to approach health and environment and animals, and now the economics behind it, which are just incredible. And you always hear the reasons why people don't want to give up meat and dairy. And some of them I think you address in your book, things like people think that if they treat the animals, I'm going to use air quotes, humanely, isn't that better? Is that healthier? Is it better economically? And you've done quite a lot of study here showing that economically it's not a better alternative.
Well, that's right. And in fact...
And environmentally.
That's right. And I'm glad you used the air quotes around humanely, because one of the other things that I look at in this book is how animals are treated in factory farms. And we're used to hearing that there are some ethical issues in factory farms. So listeners won't be surprised to learn that there are some ethical problems. But I sort of found systemic legal issues that go much more deeply than even most informed vegans are aware. You know, for example, there's this concept in this country of something called a customary farming exemption. And what these customary farming exemptions do is they take a formerly robust animal anti-cruelty statute, for example, Connecticut used to have a statute that says it's illegal to engage in cruel behavior toward any animal. And then the legislature comes along and enacts a customary farming exemption, which carves out a massive exemption for all farm animals. So in Connecticut, for example, today, it's, and I'm going to actually read a quote here, it's legal to maliciously and intentionally maim, mutilate, torture, wound, or kill an animal, provided the act is done while following generally accepted agricultural practices. Now, so to paraphrase Connecticut's law, it's legal to intentionally torture a farm animal. And as shocking as that is, virtually every U.S. state has the exact same law in place. They're worded a little differently. And these laws apply to all sorts of things that you wouldn't think. Organic animals that are raised organically, or animals that are raised in cage-free conditions, in free-range conditions, and even in many instances to animals that are raised in humane conditions. So it's just, there's a lot that we don't know about what's going on in these factory farms, and there's so much industry misinformation and sort of attempts to placate consumers, and unfortunately, these so-called humane ways of raising animals just don't really cut it because of these exemptions that exist.
I know many of us want to believe that our government is there to protect us and make sure that we're getting quality products, and most of us just want to trust and not dig any deeper. And we're continually discovering that regulations aren't, there are regulations. Some of them are actually good, but they're not enforced. We need some regulations, like the thing you just read, are horrific. There's so much out there that we don't know about. And getting back to what I mentioned before about people thinking if they eat more humanely, I remember doing a simple calculation one time, just trying to estimate the landmass on the earth and if we could grass feed all of the cows that were being raised for meat. And I quickly determined we didn't have enough landmass to grass feed without confining these animals. And I didn't even think about chickens. And, you know, you bring up this study that was done, and they're just, that's the problem. We're eating too many animals, and there isn't room if we were going to let them roam and graze like this image we have in our mind of the idyllic farm, which really doesn't exist anymore. We have to confine these animals.
That's right. You know, many people are familiar with Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, in which he profiles this sort of now famous farm called Polyface Farm, run by Joel Spelaton. And Polyface looks like a great place to be an animal. There's a lot of pasture, and the animals rotate through it. But as I show in the book, that Polyface model, even though it looks nice, it's completely unworkable in this country. If we wanted to raise all of our animals in that sort of pasture setting, we would need something like 300,000 additional farms of that size, something like twice the size of Texas. So the land, as much as people would like to think that buying grass-fed beef or pastured pork or even free-range chicken is a good thing, it just doesn't work. It's not sustainable because the land doesn't exist.
Another thing that doesn't work, when people talk about vegetarian diets being healthier, people are slowly getting that message and slowly weaning themselves off red meat, moving to chicken and fish, and then kind of a little bit getting off of chicken, and fish is the big health food. And everybody thinks they need a little of it or a lot of it, and that it's good for us. And I don't think most people realized the environmental issues where so many fish species today are extinct and becoming extinct. We've got this aquaculture. And there was actually some of the things you were talking about regarding aquaculture I didn't even know. But can we talk a little bit about the fish side of eating animals? A lot of people don't even realize that fish are animals.
Yeah, You're right. You're right. Now, you know, so we have two ways of producing fish in the world. One is capture fishing, which is to go out and fish with a big boat and catch wild fish. Capture fishing has depleted a third of the world's fisheries. These are the major fish stocks. The cod fishery in the North Atlantic has completely collapsed and is closed.
Mm.
And experts predict that by about 2050, if we keep going at the pace we're going, all commercially fished species on the planet will have collapsed. Now, on the flip side of that, we've got fish farming. That's often touted as sort of this, you know, silver bullet of food production, because that's going to be the future of how we produce fish around the world. But the latest science on fish farming also shows that is damaging the world's oceans, because, among other things, fish farming results in a highly concentrated area of fish waste. Often there are a lot of chemicals. Farmers, just as factory farmers dose their animals with antibiotics, fish farmers dose their animals with antibiotics and with other chemicals designed to keep fish lice off of them. And fish farming, sadly, doesn't work either.
Well, the thing that I was surprised to read, that's something I hadn't read before, is all about the emotions that fish have and the fact that they can feel pain, and how some scientific studies are starting to recognize that, even though the studies you mentioned are so horrible how they figured these things out. And then the other part is in these factory farms for fish and aquaculture, even if we have the technology to make their environment clean, and there are some groups that are doing all kinds of fancy things with technology to filter their water, the fact that they're so confined affects them so emotionally. And that's, for some of us who care about what other species may feel, is one issue, but it's also not good for producing food.
Well, yeah, you're exactly right. Fish farms are just the factory farms of the sea. And just as land animals in factory farms are subject to what this concept of hyper-confinement, the exact same kind of hyper-confinement applies to fish in factory farms. So we find, for example, 27 18-inch trout crammed into a space the size of a bathtub, typically. And as you point out, the recent research does measure how these animals experience these conditions, and fish have the stress hormone cortisol, just like we do, and they've actually measured elevated cortisol levels in fish that are hyper-confined, in fish that are subject to the kinds of infestations of lice that this hyper-confinement causes, and in a variety of other scenarios. But yeah, and as you also say, it's true that the latest research now finds that fish feel pain. So this sort of concept of catch and release that some people are fond of,
mm-hmm.
Well, a trout has something like 20 pain receptors in his or her face, and they feel pain just as we would.
Oh, yeah. I'm taking a deep breath here, feeling their pain. You have estimated towards the end of your book that the external cost of U.S. animal food production totals $414.8 billion.
Yeah. Gold. Massive number.
That's a massive number. Now, the biggest part of that pie is health care.
That's right.
So I think what you were trying to tell us in this story, Meadonomics, is that the government is subsidizing or encouraging behavior and consumption that ultimately leads to really bad health, and then we have even more expenses to deal with.
That's right. And for people who aren't aware of this term, externalized cost, you know, if I take my garbage to the front of my driveway and leave it there and pay a garbage collector to pick it up, I've internalized my garbage collection cost. But if I drive to a park at midnight and dump it there, I have externalized my garbage collection cost. So what I'm arguing in this book is that animal food producers are basically dumping their garbage in our parks at midnight, and that $414 billion annual total of externalized costs is more than half of what we spend each year on Social Security, just to put it in perspective. It's just a huge number.
Well, this whole concept of externalized cost has really been, unfortunately, growing and thriving, and a lot of corporations take a lot of advantage of it from the top down, passing on expenses to their suppliers and their customers so that they have to pay less and less and they can make more and more. It's quite an interesting process. Now, we've kind of very briefly touched on a number of issues in our food system where we're encouraged to eat a lot of meat and dairy, and it's not cost effective, it's not a good choice for health, environment, animals. Now the question is, what do we do about it? And you propose a meat tax.
That's right. And I know that a tax is controversial, but I think that the mechanism that I suggest is one that's relatively simple and one that could actually work. I propose a 50% excise tax at the federal level on the sale of all meat and dairy products. An excise tax is just like a sales tax. And at the same time, I suggest that we provide on average a $500 tax credit to consumers, which would have the effect of compensating for the additional food budget that people would experience as a result of the tax, so that at the end of the day, nobody spends any more than they do today on food, but the tax causes them to shift a significant portion of their buying from animal foods to plant-based foods.
It's kind of a trick with dollars.
it's kind of a trick, but when I do the math, I come up with some incredible benefits from a tax like this. For example, each year that this tax is in effect, we could save 170,000 people's lives. We could save 26 billion animals' lives. We could return to its native state almost 600,000 square miles of U.S. land that's now used to graze livestock or raise crops to feed them, and in the future would not be needed for that purpose. That's like twice the size of Texas. So this tax would have a lot of it. We'd also put $30 billion back into the U.S. Treasury, by the way, which could be used to provide food stamps or other subsidies to low-income people or a variety of other programs.
And we have already a very messy financial structure in our government. Lots of loopholes, and so many different groups. We don't even know what they're doing, if they're doing them efficiently, or how much corruption is involved. One more tax is, how do we even get that into the conversation?
Well, that's a good question. I knew when I proposed this tax that it wasn't something that we were going to pass right away, but I thought that it would be, now is sort of a good time to start a dialogue about this and put the idea on the table. If other people are interested in it, maybe it could get some legs and some traction. And ultimately, this is how any change has to start. Somebody has to come out and say, this might work, and if people get behind it, it just might. Who knows?
Well, I agree that in order to make change, there has to be some sort of economic incentive. And it's unfortunate, but in our capitalistic system, that's how things work. And most people are not aware of how their food quality affects their health and their lifestyle and all life on Earth. And they're looking for, I think you said it somewhere, now that I'm thinking about it, where people are looking for quantity, not quality. And in order to make change, or in order to get people to move in the direction and buy the things you want and not buy the things you don't want, you have to play with the price.
Well, that's exactly right. We're as a nation, we're consuming twice the meat that we did just 75 years ago. And one of the main reasons for that is that on an inflation-adjusted basis, because of things like this massive externalization of costs that we've been talking about, the prices of animal foods have been dropping.
Mm-hmm.
The price of chicken, if you adjust it for inflation, the price of chicken is almost 80% lower than it was in 1935. At the same time, we, as a nation, consume per person six times more chicken than we did in 1935. That's exactly what the law of demand predicts. The law of demand says as prices go down, consumption goes up. And the only way to change that, or let me, a significantly powerful way to change that is to increase the prices of animal foods, let them rise to what should be their normal level instead of holding them down artificially, and the effect of that rise would be to cause consumption to drop in a significant way.
I just realized there was something I wanted to ask you about earlier, and I didn't, so I'm going to do it now. And that is, in addition to talking about the economics of locally grown food, and you show how economically buying locally is not always the best choice, that some countries can raise animal food a lot more cheaply than other countries, and shipping them from one place to another is not a significant addition to the cost. Is that the same with plant foods?
Yes, the concept of local production requires that we do what's called a life cycle assessment on food in order to determine its carbon output. And the typical life cycle assessment finds that processing, production, and preparation, three P's, account for something like 70 or 80% of the carbon footprint of any food, plant or animal, while transportation accounts for something like 11%. So for any food, while local consumption is good, you know, you want to support your local farmer, the question is actually more complicated if you're trying to determine what is this food's carbon output. Am I, from a carbon perspective, am I better buying locally or from a distant continent? The answer isn't always clear, but yes, it's the complexities can be equally difficult for both plants and animals. I think in general, not being too dogmatic about local consumption is probably a good idea.
Good. And then the other one is about organic, and I wasn't sure if your results were applied also to plant food as well as animal foods, because you show in many cases that raising an animal with non-organic methods is more economical.
Yeah, so the issue for organic also that I wanted to explore in the book is, you know, there's a lot of enthusiasm from the organic community to the effect that organic production is environmentally friendly because it results in less carbon emissions and other harmful byproducts like nitrogen and phosphates and the things that enter our waterways. But what I find is that for animal foods, it's really a completely mixed bag, and you cannot categorically say organically producing animal foods is more environmentally friendly than producing those foods in inorganic ways, just because mainly, it takes more land to raise animals organically, and it takes more time because they just grow more slowly. If you're not dosing chickens with growth-promoting antibiotics, guess what? They grow a lot more slowly, and that means they've got more time in the hen house, you've got to run the lights more, you've got to run the generators more, et cetera.
Okay, well, we've come to the end of the program, and I wanted to mention that you are doing a book signing here in New York City next week.
I am.
September 9th?
That's right, September 9th at Moo Shoes, M-O-O Shoes. It's a vegan shoe store at 78 Orchard Street.
And what time is that at?
That is from 7 p.m. to 8:30 p.m. on Monday night, September 9th.
Yeah, that's the Moose Shoes is a great vegan shoe store, and the owners, Erica and Sarah Kuversky, have been so wonderful at having a number of different book signings there. It's a great space, and they've been very generous with it. So it should be a fun event.
I think it will be great.
And then the bottom line is we should just lighten up on that meat and dairy, shouldn't we?
We really should.
Yeah.
Even better, go vegan, right?
Go vegan, yay, that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm putting it out there, too. Meat tax, whatever it takes.
Yeah,
whatever it takes. Well, David, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food, and all the best to you, and great luck with this book, Meatonomics.
Thanks very much for having me, Karen. I really appreciate it.
Okay, take care. Well, that was David Simon, and a really good read, Meatonomics. If you don't understand what's going on in our food system or just need a source where it's all in one place, this is a good place to start, Meatonomics. Okay, let's take a quick break, and next we're going to be speaking with Bava Ram, the author of Warrior Pose. We'll be right back.